using satire to expose the perversion of virtue.
I kind of wanted to riff on the ways people sort of exploit language, exploit these sort of virtues that we supposedly hold dear to our hearts to allow evil to run rampant, basically, to allow evil to go unchecked, to allow black people to be murdered with impunity.
That's Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya talking about his award-winning story collection, Friday Black. Then, the art of the really, really short story.
The form, the short form, has a character arc. It has a compelling situational dynamic, and it has the concentration of language that kind of brings it all together.
That's Mark Russell Gillade. We talk with him about his short story collection, Navigating by Stars. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya's stories in his collection Friday Black are a bitingly satiric look at what it's like to be young and black in racist America. By placing ordinary characters in extraordinary situations, Adjei-Brenya reveals the violence, injustice, and painful absurdities that black men and women contend with every day. In his story, The Finkelstein Five, Adjei-Brenya gives us an unforgettable reckoning of the brutal prejudice of our justice system. In his story, Zimmerland, we see a far too easy-to-believe imagining of racism as sport. And the stories Friday Black and How to Sell a Jacket as Told by Ice King show the horrors of consumerism and the toll it takes on us all. His extraordinary debut collection is a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Award for Best First Book, and it won the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award. Adjei-Brenya's work has appeared or is forthcoming in numerous publications, including Guernica, Compose, Printer's Row, Gravel, and the Breakwater Review. Well, Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is a terrific collection of stories, Friday Black, a tough one to read, I think, in the best tradition of biting satire. I mean, would you call most of these stories or many of these stories satire?
You know, sometimes I think they kind of push into the world of satire. Often, I think because of the reality of the world, they're not as satirical as one would hope. But for sure, yeah, I think they are, you know, I do play with sort of exaggeration to make a point, hyperbole, to sort of maybe illuminated issues. And so some of them are somewhat satirical.
Yeah, I mean, that was my sense also, that the world that we're living in today is already one that maybe a couple of years ago we might have thought might be satire, and now they go beyond the pale, although many of the things that you talk about in this book have really been going on for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in some ways, like maybe the packaging or the way we're able to perceive what's wrong about our sort of culture, our society is worse now. I think we have a, you know, maybe focusing or starting with the president who just maybe so irredeemable in like pretty much any area that you can imagine. But all throughout, we have a lot of sort of insidious darkness that I think we're maybe starting to pay attention to.
Yes, and the first story is emblematic of that. It is The Finkelstein, referring to a library, actually referring to a terrible hate crime that happens in front of a library. Tell us briefly what happens in that story.
The Finkelstein Five is a story in which five young black people who were outside of a library are murdered via chainsaw by a white person who was then acquitted of any wrongdoing.
And these are children we're talking about, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to read page 5 because I'm not so sure how much of an exaggeration it is. In this is the trial in which this man, George Wilson Dunn, is acquitted. And his defense attorney says during the trial, "I don't know about you all, but I love my children more than I love the, quote, law, unquote. And I love America more than I love my children. That's what this case is about. Love with a capital L and America. That is what I'm defending here today. My client, Mr. George Dunn, believed he was in danger. And you know what? If you believe something, anything, then that's what matters the most." Talk about that paragraph.
I kind of wanted to riff on the ways people sort of exploit language, exploit these sort of virtues that we supposedly hold dear to our hearts to allow evil to run rampant, basically, to allow evil to go unchecked, to allow black people to be murdered with impunity. And I think in America particularly, we have a lot of – we sort of project a lot of pride in – this sort of idea of freedom, and we have all these symbols of justice and the land of opportunities, like the motto. But time and time again, we see people who are the most vulnerable being murdered, literally murdered, and their murderers go free. And so I kind of wanted to play with sort of the different ways that happens, the different ways we see perpetrators sort of bend our language and our symbols for themselves.
I'm talking with you just 2 days after another terrible hate crime happened in a synagogue. That one brought to mind what happened when Dylann Roof killed a whole lot of people in a black church. What are your thoughts about how these two hate crimes both are and are not related? How are they the same? How are they different?
First, all my love and support to the victims of this Tree of Life shooting and to that community. I'm sure there's a lot to say about each of these cases, and there's more than I could probably say in the time I have. But I think what we know is the same is we have someone entering a place that is obviously where people go to try to feel safe, to try to feel connected with the higher power, to try to practice their religion and community and faith. And we have someone breaching that space to murder them, whether it be because of their race, because of their religion. We have someone who is so consumed by hatred that they would literally murder completely innocent people because they were different from them. And it's extremely heartbreaking. I have a student who, that's the synagogue that she grew up in. And, I'm so sad that she's even emailing me. She said, to let me know that she's, going to go home and regroup with her friends and family. And it's just, the idea that she would even have to, I told her, obviously you don't worry about any classes right now, obviously. And I'm so sorry that this is the world. So yeah, it's terrible and it's scary. And what's similar is, and what keeps on happening is, we have a group of people who overtly hate others, and their primary way of engaging with people unlike them is through hatred. and they represent a significant chunk of what people want to call like the right or whatever. And it's sort of terrifying to imagine, there's like this sort of false equivalence between like these two sides of our political spectrum. We have this side and that side, there's just people just hashing out ideas. No, one side of these people would literally, very literally, prefer many people to be dead. And it's rough. Sorry, I think I got off track a little bit, but yeah, it's terrible.
And yet, I also thought that what was different is the utter shock. Now, I am Jewish, and it actually doesn't come that much as a shock to me, because in some way I've been expecting this to happen all my life. But it's much more of something that happens, as is so clear in your book, Nane Kwame Adjei Brenya, in the stories in your book, Friday Black, something that happens on a routine basis, maybe not mass murder in a place of worship, but murder of innocent black people being gunned down every day, and then the perpetrators getting acquitted. That's a difference.
Yeah, I think it, and part of why in that story, you know, I think why the sort of hyperbole comes with this sort of chainsaw is that I think we almost got used to black people being murdered by gun. We're almost used to it now. And the chainsaw, I think, makes you pay attention a little bit because it is so visceral and violent. But it is, for me, what I hope that people remember is, like, you know, if you kill someone with a gun, you kill them with a chainsaw, they're just as dead either way.
Exactly. Another aspect of that story, just to stay within another minute, is how much you talk in the story about something that had never occurred to me because I'm white, dialing blackness up and down. Talk about that phenomenon.
Yeah. In the story, there's a blackness scale through which the protagonist sort of slides on a 10-point scale. And it's a way for me to sort of literalize what we call code switching. You know, if I'm in this space or that space, you kind of, I think most black people are pretty well aware that the fact of them being black in the eyes of some is negative. And to work, to be able to get a job, to literally eat, to be able to feel safe in certain spaces, you have to negotiate that fact against that fact. And that's a kind of violence, you know, to have to like shift and decide who and how you're going to be perceived for your own well-being. And literally, potentially for your own safety. And I think I just made that sort of a literal conceit in the story that kind of goes against that sort of backdrop of this court case that's happening. So this is someone who has to move his blackness accordingly, depending on the space he's in, while also in the back of his mind or sometimes in the front of his mind, these five young black people were murdered.
And moving it in what way? Describe it.
So up or down, meaning acting less what is might be perceived as black to be more palatable to the people around you, or moving that up to be, in this case, in the story, to be in solidarity with the people with the young children who were just murdered. What's important also, I think, with maybe hopefully not ruining too much, is this is a conceit that works in the story, but is, you know, is not exactly reality based. And I mean that in the sense that it's, you know, there is no definable blackness. Blackness is so many different things. Blackness comes in so many different shapes and sizes. Blackness is the whole universe and more, you know. But there is sort of tokenized and sort of there's like touchstone stereotypes that we understand. And I think it's like negotiating around those so that the people that are around us and that are taking us in might not do whatever strange thing they might do.
So another story, Nana, in this collection of stories, Friday Black, goes on a similar theme of the first one we've been talking about, but focuses on the commercialization of racist violence and in the guise of trying to, in some bizarre way, address racial violence. It's a very interesting story. It's called Zimmerland. Tell us about it.
The story Zimmerland, it takes place in a sort of, they call it a justice park. It's something like a theme park or almost like a live action arcade in which characters or patrons can come in and act out sort of justice scenarios or live action instances where they have to make decisions. And how that ends up manifesting is white people come and pretend or through the arcade space, murder our protagonist over and over and over again. It's, and that's how, like, that's what ends up happening. It's meant to be something different, maybe, and it ends up just being white people coming to murder this young person repeatedly.
Yeah, and so the place says, they state as their mission to create a safe space for adults to explore problem solving, justice, and judgment. It is such an utter perversion of that. Connect the dots between the mission statement and what actually happens.
Well, you know, so again, like, you know, I think we like the packaging, the way we deliver messages is often a part of the violence. We have police officers are there right on there, you know, serve and protect. You know, that's their job. And yet we see, you know, often, very often, we see them murdering black people who are unarmed. So it wasn't like a big stretch for me to imagine a place that has sort of high moral symbolism or high moral virtue signals, but that operates mostly evilly.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing is, of course, safe space for adults. It then extends to children. You know, what is it like? What was it like for you in writing this story to go from, you know, kind of to step up the horror even more?
It was so when I was writing the story, a part of the like sort of central tension for me, at least, was trying to get this main character to justify his being there. Why is he allowing himself to do this? And I think what he sort of arrives at personally to like, and maybe wrongfully, is that like, you know, if I do this, maybe I'm stopping someone from getting murdered out in the real world, you know? So he's like, let me just do this thing. And I think that, so I had to up the ante a little bit. Like, I'm like, so how bad would it have to be for him to leave? And then, so we have that upping of the ante in allowing children to enter this park, which maybe was not a good space from the beginning, but then you see how far they're willing to go. And they're not, and it's made very clear it's for profit. It's a for-profit sort of model that they're doing. And like, you know what, we have, there's a new sort of population we haven't tapped into. That's the youth. So let's go get money from them too.
And this kind of theme of the connection, well, I mean, I'm not sure it's connection, but you have these kind of twin themes of, you know, racial violence and commercialization. So the title story, Friday Black, takes place on Black Friday. Tell us about the protagonist and where he works.
So the protagonist in the story, Friday Black, works in the Prominent Mall. He works in a clothing store in the mall called the Prominent Mall, and he's sort of a hardened sort of veteran salesperson in the Friday Black story. And he has to deal with sort of zombified, crazed shoppers.
Who kill each other to get the goods.
Yeah, who literally maul and kill whatever is in their path to get to their jackets.
Which actually has happened. People have been trampled to death.
Yeah, people have been trampled for televisions. A lot of people have been trampled for televisions and items, like almost annually, actually.
So talk about this intersection of commerce and hatred in one story, the Zimmerland, and commerce and greed-fueled violence in Friday Black.
I think that what's interesting is to me is like, you know, capitalism is a really interesting sort of self-cleaning oven because – and the way we teach history, it's like, you know, we're like, socialism has always failed, or we try to use examples that aren't really true socialism to like sort of make the possibility of socialism, or at least something closer to socialism, seem improbable or evil. But like slavery happened under a capitalist kind of system, you know? Capitalism is so insane that it can get humans to feel like they're good people and buy and sell other human beings. That's capitalism. So again, it's not super hard for me to make the connected dots between a capitalist consumer sort of culture and racism because they're very often tied together. Also, I think capitalism at its heart, it sort of values things as opposed to people, as opposed to humans. Capitalism at its heart values the acquisition of things. It values sort of endless growth, and it values this individual sort of wealth. And I think anyone that looks at it closely enough can see that it isn't really a humanist enterprise, and it's one of many systems that allow us to sort of dehumanize each other, as is racism.
Well, exactly. When things are everything is commercialized, then how can the humanity of anything be honored. And, you know, it reminds me of the movie The Corporation, which basically said that corporations are psychopaths.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and you don't have to look too far to think about just really any structure, any corporate structure where someone at the top has more money than a human can possibly spend, and someone in that same organization is starving, very literally. And then we've adopted a sort of philanthropy model where these billionaires can feel good about themselves because they donate millions here and there. But it, like, wouldn't it be great if instead of having millions to donate, people who worked for you had money to eat, you know, instead of you quite literally keeping this sort of loop going by you having all this excess wealth, them being sort of pinched and forced to work in these systems because there's just not that much money to go around because you have all of it. And it's just normal. We've normalized it. It's just accepted. And we actually lionize and sort of look up to these people. Look at Bezos. What a great businessman he is. When really, you know, most of these people who were quite, if you have a, I don't think there's a moral billionaire in the world.
You don't think there's a what?
A moral billionaire.
Yeah. In fact, last week we aired our interview with Anand Giridharadas about his book Winners Take All, which very precisely talks about the hypocrisy of the philanthropy of these, you know, lords of global commerce.
It's getting more and more absurd and obvious, I think. So I'm glad, because it doesn't make sense.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya about his award-winning collection of short stories, Friday Black. Now, on a more personal note, there's a wonderful story, The Hospital Where, which is in many ways a story about how you became a writer, touched by the 12-tongued God. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a story that was sort of one of the tougher ones to pull off, like, you know, sort of meta, as you say. It's kind of about a writer, kind of like about me, and sort of his antagonistic relationship with the compulsion to write, the sort of ability to write. I think most writers know it's sort of a, writing can suck. It can feel like it sucks sometimes. It's really hard. But also it's this thing we kind of feel like we have to do. While that's happening, he's also dealing with the reality of his father's declining health, or potentially his father's declining health, and him trying to move through the world thinking about these things.
Yeah, it's a lovely story. And the 12-tongued God, who is the 12-tongued God and how it put its brand on you?
Yeah, the 12-tongued God is, and again, the story, it's like sort of this almost like a muse figure, but I think as opposed to like a, you know, fairy that comes and sprinkles sort of magic on you, it's more like a meanish sort of, I don't know, sarcastic jerk that will like want you to literally, like, you know, sacrifice something to it. And for me, that was just a lot truer, especially back then, a lot truer to my writing experience. I mean, I loved writing. It was something I kind of found that made me feel sort of safe, and something that people, I feel like people couldn't take away from me. But like any obsession, you know, there's some other parts of it too. So the 12-tongued God is sort of me, my sort of the closest thing I can get to, like, maybe portraying what it's like for me, or like what it was. So I think I'm a little bit different now, but it was like for me wanting to be a writer, wanting to feel like I was seen, wanting to feel like I was good enough, begging this, like, sort of unknowable force to be, like, on the stage or be recognized or be good enough to have a story that could do something.
Yeah. So the sacrifice, what was the sacrifice and how has that changed now?
I think when you choose to be a writer, there's a lot, for me at least, there's a lot I had to sacrifice. For a long time, I didn't really, everything, and like everything kind of came second to writerly sort of pursuit. That's friends, that's family, that's relationships. You know, I almost view like other people as sort of like a liability or distraction. Again, trying to be in this obsessive mode, trying to be in this kind of place where I'm working hard all the time, I'm never letting up on anything. All this stuff is, you know, sort of 100% on all the time. I think that was a big part of it for me. And now I'm way more open. I realize it's not a weakness to have love in your life, to like care about your family, to have people and human beings come first, other human beings come first. I think, you know, I think now I know much more clearly that I'd rather be a great person than a great artist, actually. And that's as someone who takes, you know, his art very, very seriously. But, you know, you can kind of get that mode I was in is, again, I was kind of putting that capitalistic mode on art, which is a very easy, it's a sneaky kind of process. You know, you think, I'm going to be great at this thing. I'm going to prove my life for my family. I'm going to get enough stuff. I'm going to become popular. I'm going to get money, and I'm going to fix everything, you know, economically or whatever, in whatever sense. And pretty soon, all of a sudden, a switch happens that while you're in the seconds that you blink, where what was a sort of altruism kind of just becomes this ego thing. What was for somebody else becomes about self, because you don't think you're like hardly even a worthy human being until you've achieved this status. And so I think I was sort of consumed in that model for a long time. And I think it took kind of just growing up, sort of realizing there external validation will never be the highest form of fulfillment, to sort of let go of some of that parts, those parts of myself, and change my relationship to my own sort of 12-ton God, if you will.
And it doesn't hurt that you, in fact, have gotten quite a bit of acclaim. You've got George Saunders and Roxane Gay, who did blurbs for your book, and well-deserved, being considered for prizes at this point. What is the prize that you're up for at this point?
I got the 500th National Book Award, 535. I was chosen as one of the five people. They choose five people that are under the age of 35, I think, every year. So that's one. I was longlisted for the Carnegie Medal in fiction. And at this point, that's it that I think. There's probably some other things. I'm not good at keeping up with stuff.
Well, that's certainly enough. So, yeah. And who are the writers that have inspired you?
I've been inspired by a bunch of great writers. Alice Walker. You know, people talk about George Saunders a lot. He's a huge for me. Dennis Johnson, Toni Morrison, ZZ Packer. And then some people that are writing right now, like Nafisa Thompson Spires. You know, a lot of people have inspired me.
So, Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, I want to thank you so much for talking with us on Writer's Voice about your first collection of stories, Friday Black. I look forward to many more. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate this.
Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya. His short story collection, Friday Black, is a New York Times bestseller and was awarded the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award. Go to writersvoice.net to read some of Adjei-Brenya's other work. Next up, Mark Russell Dulaid and the art of the short, short story. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Do you think you could write an entire story in 500 words? Well, the first-time poet Mark Russell Dulaid tried it. He won a contest for the world's best short, short story. He went on to write more short, short stories, and they're all collected in his book, Navigating by Stars, 24 Very Short Stories of Love and Longing. Each story highlights a different character speaking in the first person about navigating their life or a particular circumstance within it. Jalay describes the narrative arc of these poignant and pointed stories with a poet's sensibility. Each becomes a tile in a mosaic, where a character in one story will reappear in another to provide a different point of view. Mark Russell Dulaid lives and writes in San Francisco, California. Well, Mark Russell Dulaid, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is the first time I think that I've read a book of such short stories. These are something like around 500 words, so maybe 2 to 3 pages. Is that right?
That's right. Somewhere between 500 and 1,000 words each story.
And you're a poet, So how did you get started on writing these short stories?
Well, I think there is something in that, but I do have a poet's sensibility. And literally, I was at my desk a few years back, and a voice just inhabited me. And if that wasn't strange enough, it was the voice of a woman in the midst of an emergency home birth. So, but I just went with it. And when it was over, I had about a page and a half of writing, but a page and a half that felt strangely complete. And I just thought, well, that's weird. What is that? Is that a prose poem? Is that a fiction story? I wasn't even sure what it was myself. And then about a month or so later, I came across an ad in the Poets and Writers magazine for something called the World's Best Short Story Contest. And I was like, oh my gosh, a short story. There's a category of shorts, typically between, 250 or 500 words, that folks out there are more knowledgeable about than I was. But nevertheless, I tightened up the story, and I mailed it in. I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. And a few months later, I was running some errands with my wife in the car, and the cell phone rang, and it was Florida State, saying that Robert Olin Butler, who was the judge of the contest, had selected The Bridges Down as the contest winner, and that he was looking so forward to meeting the woman who wrote the story. So they judge it blind, and I don't know what more to say about how the female voices inhabit my psyche.
Well, I was going to actually ask you that as my next question. Mm-hmm. The Bridges Down is a wonderful story, as are many of them in this. There are 24 very short stories of love and longing, as you say in the title. What was it like writing in a woman's voice? And you say this voice just kind of inhabited you. That's almost a kind of spiritual visitation, an epiphany of some kind.
Yeah, perhaps of some kind. I think that as a fiction writer, as I guess I've become a little bit, I feel fiction writers should be able to inhabit female characters versus male characters, whether they're male or female. But one of the approaches I had was that I sort of had the voice, and I was writing as fast as I could. But I was trying to get out of the way, and I think that's one of the ways that I can only explain it. If I hear a voice and it's a female voice, I just get out of the way, and I just let that voice kind of come to the forefront and do my best to capture it. And, of course, I do a lot of rewriting, so it's not like the voice comes out in perfect syntax, but it is a little bit of that negative capability that Keith talks about. Just let the spirit inhabit you.
And it does. Now, you mentioned before that you weren't sure if these were prose poems or if they were fiction. What were they? They are very poetic. There's some very beautiful language in them. And even the title, Navigating by Stars, itself is a very poetic cast to a title of a book of short stories. Is there a theme?
It's hard to say that there is a single theme, but I would say, in generally speaking, most of the characters, except for some of the dark comedies that are also in there, most of the characters are at some kind of spiritual crossroads in their lives. And in one of the stories, I think it's the last one now, it's now called The Way Home, character sort of says, when you don't know what to do next, when you don't know how to get happy, you just have to navigate by stars. And when that phrase came to me, then I thought that's a pretty good title upon which to hang the collection, because in some ways they are like looking at a constellation. As you may have noticed throughout the stories, there are some interrelationships, and so just like when you look at a constellation and you're trying to draw the little connections between the disparate stars, the stories too kind of form that sort of organic sort of feeling to them as they progress through the collection.
And so talking about that story, that first story, the title story, Navigating by Stars, I wonder if you'd be willing to read it to us. It's only really 2.5 pages.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
That would be great.
Navigating by Stars. Harry, Stan, and Peg, their names still legible on the wooden roadside memorial. Looks like someone's left fresh flowers. 1 year ago to the day, they'd headed down from Bolinas and across the Golden Gate Bridge to San Francisco to get tattoos and piercings. Stan and Peg hadn't stopped talking about it all week, what they would get, where they would get it. Stan was thinking of going with something tribal, maybe an armband or calf band. Peg had settled on a crimson butterfly, angled slightly on her right shoulder. And Harry? Harry wasn't much interested in tattoos. He was thinking about getting his ear pierced, probably daydreaming about studs and rings. That summer, they had each arrived at a turning point. Stan announced he was done being a handyman, was finally going to get his contractor's license. Peg was thinking about marrying Stan, though he hadn't asked her yet. And I think my brother Harry had finally made up his mind to leave Bolinas altogether, apply to college, and get his degree. The phone had rung at an awkward hour, too late at night to be good news. Stan was driving, Peg seated next to him, and then Harry, his head resting on his palm, probably gazing out the passenger window. Winding back up the mountain road toward home, Stan had misjudged the curve, and with too little room for correction, the pickup had careened over the dark ravine and dropped down into the moonlit surf below, a skid mark arcing across the lanes like a black rainbow. I was the one who talked Harry into getting the piercing. I thought he could use a little something to spruce up his image. He'd been all gloom and doom lately. I recommended a diamond stud, nothing outrageous, just a firm but understated emblem of his counterculture status. I actually thought it might help him a bit with the girls, since he wasn't breaking any records in that department either. Now the only broken record to speak of is the one that keeps running through my head whenever I can't fall asleep at night. My dear brother, I tremble as the stars come out and night falls. You out there falling through air, Peg's long hair lifting, fluttering against her face, the sudden absence of road noise. And although your story of the brief life leads only to this gravel-dusted cross etched with your name, I know you would have risen above the ravine as the truck went airborne. You would have kept on going too and not looked down. You would have fixed your green eyes steadfastly on the brightest star in the night sky and risen to meet it, just like any other future.
That's so beautiful. And to me, that is a poem. So what's the difference between a prose poem and a story, a short story?
I think that the way I look at it from my point of view is that the form, the short form, has a character arc. It has a compelling situational dynamic, and it has the concentration of language that kind of brings it all together. And I think that does differentiate a little bit from what I would consider a prose poem, which may just be a single paragraph evoking a particular sensibility or a particular emotion.
So maybe a prose poem could be a broader category, and then within it could be this kind of a... I mean, you could have a very short story that's not so poetic, but your work is different. It really is infused with the sensibility of a poet. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about navigating that line between fiction and poetry for you. I mean, is it something that you had to think about, grow into, or was it just effortless?
It was not really thought through that much. It was interesting that after that particular success of that first story, The Bridge Is Down, it kind of gave me some validation to keep exploring the form. And I subsequently wrote another story in a female voice and then another story in a male voice. And it really, what happened is with the male speaker in the third story I wrote, I realized had some connection with the character that a woman in If by Postcard was talking about. And I think at that point, you know, you put the toolkit you bring to the table is the fiction writer's toolkit. And I think that the poetic sensibility, I think, is there, perhaps, in the way I hear language, the way I write language. But nevertheless, in that, putting on that fiction writer's hat, I'm looking for a character arc. I'm looking for a character that can comes forward and really has something to say about their lives. And I think that the other thing I would note about it is they were all in first person. That was another decision that sort of came organically. Writing characters in first person really pushes that fictional kind of mask that happens.
That fictional kind of mask?
Yeah, you know, so that you're actually in almost inhabiting the character as you write the story, because you're writing in the I versus, you know, the third person narration.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with poet and story writer Mark Russell Gillade about his short story collection, Navigating by Stars. Yeah, and the two stories that are linked by that character, although there is a third story which is tangential to it, I think were two of my favorites in the book. In If by Postcard, on page 20, why don't you tell us what the story is about, and then I'll ask my question.
If by Postcard, a woman is, it's just interesting. Harold Bloom has characterized some of Shakespeare's soliloquies as characters overhearing themselves. And in a lot of the stories, the characters are overhearing themselves because they're speaking out loud and coming to terms with a situation or circumstance in their lives. In If by Postcard, a woman's reflecting on the breakup of a relationship. And as it turns out, the fellow she was involved with broke up with her by sending a postcard. And the story begins with her saying that sometimes breakups arrive by letter, sometimes by postcard. Of the two, I by far prefer the letter. And she obviously feels a little bit slighted. But nevertheless, that story kind of allows the character to express their feelings of disappointment at the end of that relationship. And we get to a little sense of who that man was, too, by some of his characteristics. For instance, he was a stutterer and was a musician.
And we get a very different sense of who he was in another story. But before we go on to that one, she says at one point, she's an older woman. She's having an affair with this younger man. And she says, then one evening, feeling dangerously romantic and lighter in spirit than I had for a long time, I wagered those three little words that seemed to heave so much weight. And just like that, the angels fled. You know, we all know what those three little words are. And I mean, that really struck me, those three little words that seemed to heave so much weight. And no need to actually say them. But then later on, we get to see the same story from the man's side, where she, you know, might have been interpreting the postcard as a kind of throwaway thing. Oh, you know, when it's really over, you just, you know, I do a postcard because, you know, it's basically here today, gone tomorrow. Whereas for him, the postcard is precisely the thing he needs to express, you know, everything he wants to express to her. I mean, you know, and the reason that he leaves her, maybe because of those three little words, but not at all in the sense that she thinks.
That's right. He's in his story, we learn how self-conscious he becomes when he's nervous, and he projects that if he were to have a face-to-face conversation with this woman, he would be fumbling and stuttering all over the place, and he just says, I can't face that, and I think I'll write a letter, or better yet, I'll write a postcard. And that's how he comes to do that, and indeed, there's a little bit of irony there in how you first believe that this woman has been slighted, but then when you see his point of view, it may be flawed, but it's genuine. It's his genuine point of view.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and the stories are also, I mean, it's so short, so there has to be in the narrative arc, there has to be a shift in many of these stories, something that kind of hits you at the end, because you kind of have to get to the point of the story quite quickly. And I'm thinking of the story The Odds. There's a very sudden shift in the story and in the life of a person who is referenced in the story. And, you know, it made me think about that is how life is. You know, things happen completely unexpectedly that completely change your life in an instant. And you have a way, you know, again, a poem has a way of saying things in a very terse way that gets right to the emotion, that kind of opens up an avenue to the emotion of it. And that's what these stories do with their brevity.
Thank you. Yes, I think that what you're touching on there about this opening is really the key, because I think when you read a really good poem, It comes to an end, but something else leaps out of it, right? It expands. It keeps something else. You're opened up into some other kind of feeling or evocation. And a great poem has that resonance. And I think from what readers have told me about the stories, a lot of the stories have that kind of an ending where the story has come to an end, but there's something perhaps that wasn't actually said, but that is just evoked. And it's in The Bridges Down when the moment of the birth comes, about the baby that comes through, travels through water to take its first breath. The story ends, but there's also some sort of a beginning that is somehow implied in that.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mark Russell Gillade about his book of 24 very short stories. It's called Navigating by Stars. So now there's one story that's really an outlier in terms of, you know, the sensibility we've been talking of, and that's the Brain Power story, both in substance and in style. So tell us about that story.
As I put the collection together, certain of them really didn't fit into sort of the mosaic that was forming around the interrelationships of the characters. There were just some quirky stories. Certainly, Brain Power is one of those stories, and actually, strangely inspired by a moment that I was on a bus on Columbus Avenue in New York, and it was the actor Tony Randall who got on the bus and sat I looked at him, he looked at me, and he took a seat right in front of me, and I was just looking at the back of his head, and I was like, holy crap, that's Tony Randall. And that sensibility, that the idea of a character sitting on a bus going through New York, just kind of stuck with me as that story came about. And it's a story of definitely an outlier character in some ways, who seems to be spending his day riding a bus from one end of the route to the other and sitting in the bus for the return ride back. And it's just one of those weird stars in the constellation.
And did I have it wrong then? Because there's also a story about global warming. Which one is that?
Oh, right. Brain Power does cover global warming. He mentions that, these things are happening in the world, and they're so large and hard to, geologic and hard to comprehend. And he makes note that as far as he can see, most people are just struggling to figure out what it is they're going to have for lunch, not how they can solve global warming.
And so isn't that funny? Because to me, that story was about global warming, maybe because it's something I think about all the time.
Yeah.
So I put a lot of my brain power to it. And for you, the story referenced really what is one very small part of that story, which is kind of, an interaction, a glance between a famous actor and the character in the story. So that's, what does that illustrate? how the two of us, focused in like a story that is just a page and a half, we both focused on a completely different thing.
I think that's great too, because when you look at the night sky, you might see the shape of a bear, and I might see the shape of a horse or a unicorn. And I think that there's room for, folks to settle on different interpretations of what goes on in the story. I think in some of the stories, some folks might have more compassion or understanding to certain characters than others. Some people might say, well, that person's a whiner, or that person shouldn't be complaining about that. So I think we all bring our personal biases and life experiences to the stories, and sure, you're going to have different readings of it, and I think that's a good thing. I don't want to be didactic. I mean, I didn't want to write a didactic story about global warming, but this particular character was certainly preoccupied. The story does frame, does begin and end with that. It's true.
Yeah. So does that ever disconcert you? I mean, you say you welcome that, of course, but I mean, we saw, just taking it as an example, we saw the same story in such a different light. Does that ever disconcert you as a writer? Do you feel, and especially as a poet, I think, where poetry is so open to interpretation. I mean, I interviewed a poet last year, Catherine Levy, and you know, I gave my idea of what the poem was about during the interview, and she said, you know, I never thought of it as of being about that, you know, completely different. So I guess, you know, is that disconcerting that you kind of, when you put your story out there, that you lose control over its reception?
Oh, I don't know. I don't find that disconcerting. I think it's just the way that art and writing is, whether it's poetry or fiction. And I'm also startled sometimes, and I'm sure you've had this experience too, where you read a poem or you read a story, and inside, as you're reading it, it's your own internal narrator that's reading it to you. And then you might have an opportunity to actually see the poet at a reading, or, you know, hear an author reading, and the way that they read it doesn't match at all the voice you had inside your head. And, you know, you have to kind of adjust to that. I've had that experience many times. So I think the best job you can do as a writer is just be true to your own voice. And I think that for me, listening to the words and reading work back out loud to myself so that I hear it the way I want to hear it, it's really where my role ends. And if those stories go out in the world and they're heard differently or read differently, then I think that's fine too. That's great.
It's that connection between the writer and the reader, really, which is an active one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, I'd like to end on, I think, my favorite line in the book. It's at the end. The line is prefaced by referencing the Milky Way. The Milky Way swirls overhead. And then you say, or the person in the story says, we're in the middle of that mass of stars, or so I'm told. And beyond that, the constellations print out words in a language that I cannot fathom. Can you just maybe comment on that last sentence?
That's a character that is just trying to make sense of their lives. And in that moment, there's that analogous feeling that as impossible it is for them to decipher and completely translate what the night sky looks like, I think their own internal changes and their own internal processes are also, they're there, but they're hard to explain, and they're hard to really articulate. And I think it's a little bit of a statement of surrender, really, in that particular story.
Right. Well, it's a beautiful collection, and I want to thank you so much, Mark Russell Gillade, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about Navigating by Stars, 24 very short stories of love and longing. Thanks again.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Russell Gillade's short fiction has appeared in Narrative Magazine, Southeast Review, Fiction Attic, and several other e-zines. His short story, The Bridge is Down, won the World's Best Short Story Contest. It's included in his collection, Navigating by Stars. During my interview with Mark Russell Gillade, I mentioned poet Catherine Levy, who we interviewed in April of 2018. Let's listen to her poem, Driving All Night, which I asked her to read during the interview.
Driving All Night. You have picked out one of my favorite poems in the book. The poems in this series involve a kind of travel that doesn't entail ever arriving anywhere. Maybe travel for the sake of travel, which perhaps is what life is about. I can travel to the crack in the world on the deck, sitting in the sunlight claiming it is safe here, no one is listening. It is better to claim when no one is listening. Think of that poet pacing along the beach, shouting to the waves, I am free, I am whole, knowing no one is listening, and plunging his fist into the air, screaming, I can make love to the sea, cradled in the knowledge that no one is listening, that no one he needs, more than a lover, even more than the sound of his own voice. If there isn't a God, there is always the air, and the blinded birds, and the crocuses crashing. It is spring, they are crying. With no voice, we can still sing.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And also, you know, blindness. I mean, again, there's a repetition of that word and that idea throughout this book. So what is the significance of blindness in the poems?
You know, there's a Rethke line that's been quoted quite a lot in my literary circles, at least, in the past dreadful year that we've spent. And it's, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. And, I mean, that's an interesting, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question about that leitmotif in this book. I think that that image relates to Rethke's line that with blindness, with poverty, with things being taken away, paradoxically, you can sometimes see better. And this is a poem of negative capability, of all the assumption, you know, Keats' notion of negative capability, the ability to be in doubts and uncertainties. I'm destroying the quote, I'm sorry, without any irritable reaching after facts. I mean, I didn't start the book, start the poem thinking it was a poem about negative capability, but when I read it, I believe that that's what it's about. You strip away things, you strip away assumptions, you strip away all of the footholds in life, the ability to see clearly. And sometimes, because you've stripped those things away, you can see more clearly. It opens doors. For me, that's what's going on in this poem.
Poet Catherine Levy talking about and reading her poem, Driving All Night. To listen to the entire interview, go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.